Welcome. I'm going to get started. My name is Veronica Roberts, and I am a curatorial assistant in the Department of Painting and Sculpture here at MoMA. And I also was the special projects coordinator for the Saul LeWitt retrospective that was organized by SF MoMA and traveled to the Whitney. And we're here today to talk about Saul LeWitt. And I wanted to mention that there are two wonderful, wonderful wall drawings upstairs on the sixth floor, included with the exhibition color chart. And if you haven't seen the show, it's really pretty wonderful. And the two works by Saul, I think even if you're a devotee of his works, they'll surprise you. So be sure to see the show. It's only going to be here. It's here till May 12th, so be sure to catch it in the next few months. And there will be a brown bag lunch about color chart, I believe, the week after next, back in the usual classroom B. So come back for that, too. And I'll be talking about the two wall drawings in the show and later in my talk. And if you haven't had a chance to go to Dia Beacon yet, it's well worth the train ride just for the space alone. But there's a wonderful installation of about 14 wall drawings by Saul. And he actually selected them before he passed away last year. He selected which works were going to be there and was guided some of the choices. And they're just sublime. I mean, I think it's one of the most beautiful installations I've ever seen. And it's wonderful to see so many of them, so many important ones all in one place. And it was supposed to close in September of last year, but they've extended it. So you have until September of this year to go see that. And lastly, thanks to some audience members who were here on Monday, I learned that there is also a show of, that's not a Saul LeWitt piece, I just don't have any images of it yet because the show hasn't happened. There's a wonderful, will be a wonderful exhibition of his structures, his three-dimensional work at Storm King. So I'm giving you lots of summer field trip, road trip Saul LeWitt options. Storm King will reopen in May, and they'll have works inside the building, and then there will be some outdoor pieces as well. And I think it's open only until November because it's sort of weather permitting. But go check that out too. And lastly, Saul's work is ubiquitous. I could just give a whole talk of telling you where to go. The Mass MoCA in the Berkshires has been planning for a number of years a huge wall drawing retrospective. There are going to be over 100 wall drawings on view at this museum in North Adams. It will open. I mean, it's going to take them months. Fortunately, it's a building that isn't occupied right now, so they can take their time. This huge group is going to take their time to create 100 plus wall drawings in the space. And as you can see from this model that's on their website, what's interesting is it's a three-story building. I mean, it's 27,000 square feet. It's going to be the most LeWitt wall drawings I think you could ever see in one space. And it looks to me from the model that they've separated out the three kinds of wall drawings that he did over the course of his career. He started with pencil and crayon and early on, and that looks like, and colored pencil too, on the first floor. It looks like that's what they're dedicating the first floor to. And then I believe if you look at the top floor, that looks like his ink wash wall drawings, which he started doing in the 80s after he moved to Italy. And then in the middle, you can see his acrylic wall drawings, which he did, which came after the ink washes, mainly in the 90s and to the present. So you also have plenty of time to catch this show. It will be up for a minimum of 25 years, maybe more, so plenty of time to see it. But without further ado, let me start talking about LeWitt's work. And it's hard to talk about it in some ways because it's he made over 1,200 wall drawings by the time he passed away. So it's any talk is bound to be just a very limited portion of his work. But here's an early piece on the left that perhaps strikes people as not familiar. It's called Run 1 through 4. And I paired it with this Muybridge photograph because Saul... one of the most important and perhaps unexpected influences on his work is the work of Edward Muybridge, the photographer. And I remember him telling me that he found, I believe when he lived in the Lower East Side in New York, when he moved into his apartment, he found a book by Muybridge that had been left behind by the previous tenant. And was looking through it, and as you can see from the left in this early work where he's sort of done almost an homage, where you have this running figure clearly thinking about Muybridge's motion studies. But But I think you'll also see that Muybridge ends up influencing, this is an obvious comparison, but if you think about the wall drawings, and I'll get back to this later, but if you think about the wall drawings, Muybridge continues to be an influence, and I'll talk about this in just a moment. But I also wanted to mention that this early work, you can also sense the influence of Jasper Johns. And if you are familiar with any of Jasper John's flag paintings or number paintings, particularly those flat works, and Saul was actually working at MoMA in the early 60s when he made this work. It would have been a fabulous time to be a guard at the Museum of Modern Art because he worked at the book counter and as a night receptionist. But at that time, Robert Ryman, who's an artist in our collection, and Lucy Lepard, the wonderful art critic and writer, was working in the library. You had Dan Flavin also was working as a guard. I mean, it was a pretty great moment in MoMA's history. And he was looking at Jasper John's work at that moment in his career. I mean, he was at the museum. It was pretty easy to find. This is a work that's also on view on the fourth floor. I wanted to talk briefly about Saul's structures. And I have to admit, the first time I saw this work, I thought it was kind of dull, kind of boring. In seeing where it led, I think it's actually quite remarkable and interesting. Saul was interested in and talked to Flavin and Ryman at this moment as they're working at MoMA, and he's at the beginning of his career, and they were talking about getting away from sort of the emotional subjectivity of abstract expressionism and trying to find a new language and a new way of looking at art, since it had already been, the sort of subjectivity in painting had really already been perfected and mastered. And so he was literally thinking about, reducing art to basics, to this, going back to square one, or in this case, you could call it rectangle one. So basically he stripped the skin of a rectangle here and painted it black. And it's probably the only work that you can think of, one of the few works that you could sort of see him as, it looks more minimal. He actually didn't really like the term minimalism. He never really felt very comfortable with it. And as you'll see, he ended up moving far away from minimalism. But let me just read a really one of my favorite things that he said about minimalism in his paragraphs on conceptual art. And any artist or human being should read this paragraphs on conceptual art that he wrote in 67. It's a wonderful text. And he says, "Recently there has been much written about minimal art, but I have not discovered anyone who admits to doing this kind of thing. Therefore, I conclude that as part of a secret language that art critics use when communicating with each other through the medium of art magazines, mini art is best because it reminds one of miniskirts and long-legged girls. It must refer to very small works of art. This is a very good idea. Perhaps mini art shows could be sent around the country in matchboxes. Or maybe the mini artist is a very small person, say under 5 feet tall. If so, much good work will be found in the primary schools." So he quickly moves away from this, and interestingly, he starts painting his structures, as he called them, because he didn't like the sort of grandiose idea of sculpture, and he'd already dispensed with a base and a pedestal, and it was, made out of wood, it's not bronze, it's not representational. I mean, it's so far removed from, in some ways, the tradition of sculpture. So he called it structure, and he started painting them white, because he felt that white was less expressive, and he also changed the rectangle to a cube, and he pretty much worked in his structures. He made white modular structures, like the one you see here, for the rest of his life, for the rest of his career. So he quickly dispensed with, but you can see his thought process and how he's getting to that point, and then where it leads to, these incredibly wonderful, I mean, to see these works, you have to move up and down. You look kind of funny in the gallery because you're kind of, I'm going like this and like this and up and down and bobbing around because your perspective changes as you look at them. And this one's called 1357911, and let me find my pointer. That's because... Sorry, this is a little washed out, but you can see this is one unit wide, and this is 3 units wide, 5 units wide, 7, 9, 11. And look at where this led. This is the variety of white modular cube structures that just a sampling of the many ones that he's done. He also wanted to move away from sort of the preciousness of sculpture, and these were almost always done in wood and painted white or in metal. But he moves away. So he moves away, though, from this seemingly more minimal modular cube or rectangle to thinking about systems. And this is really the leap at this point with this work in Complete Open Cubes. He's moving away from minimalism and to conceptual art. He really quickly becomes more interested in the ideas behind works of art and the concepts behind works of art. And he talks about that also in paragraphs on conceptual art and about how he creating a plan and allows for a way of dispensing with subjectivity. And it's the idea that is the machine that creates the work of art. And this work, this if you think about it, the idea or the system here is incomplete open cubes. How many of them are there? So he had to figure this out. It took a lot longer than you might think. At minimum, you have to have three sides to have an incomplete cube. A cube has 12 sides. An open cube has 12 sides. So a minimum would be three sides, and the maximum to be incomplete would be 11. But can you guess how many there were? Anyone want to hazard a guess? 122? Yeah, there are 122. And here you see on the left the one of the many works that's part of this this idea that he generated, and he puts it on a grid on a gridded base, and then there are these photographs representing all the different incomplete open cube permutations that there are. So again, I don't even think he could have envisioned what this work of art would look like when he came up with the idea. You can see the kind of planning and mapping it out and trying to sort it out. He started out by doing drawings and he came up with letters to assign to each side and numbers, trying to figure out all the different ways you could make an incomplete open cube. But then it became really difficult to try to keep track because, there are incomplete open cubes that if you pivoted them or mirror image, they're really the same thing. So he tried to cut out all the duplicates. So he ended up realizing he needed to figure it out using three dimensions. So what he did is he bent paper clips and pipe cleaners, and that's sort of how he sorted out the various variations to end up with a work like this. And in the last image I showed you, you can see this is one of the five-sided ones. He actually did large scale versions of these, smaller ones, photographs. There's so many different ways that he translated this idea, including a book. He also made it into a book. When he was asked at one point, that in 2000 he was asked, what if you forgot one? And he said, well, that would be great news because I hear they're selling really well. And he did sometimes forget them. These systems are actually kind of complicated. The idea and the premise may be simple, but actually figuring it out could be complicated. And one of the things that I find so wonderful about this work is that it's seemingly so logical or rational in some ways. The idea, cubes are the most rational form. He's laying it on a grid. What could be more rational and Cartesian than a grid? And yet there's something that is simultaneously totally absurd. The amount of time spent figuring out how many sides there are to a cube. And there was something in Saul's work that for all of its seeming rationality or logic or systems, the systems themselves can be quite irrational and quite wonderful in that way. But I want to get, and this is just, this is the schematic version of incomplete open cubes, and you can see on the top, he's organized it, and this is the way it's organized on the grid too, is he's organized it by the top row is the three-sided incomplete open cubes. And then you've got the four-sided, five-sided, six, seven, eight, nine, it goes down to all the very, I think it's three, and then it's, these might all be, this is four, this is five, but there are a lot of fives and sixes and sevens. And anyway, then it goes all the way down to the 11-sided one. But I wanted to get to the wall drawings. This is the first wall drawing. I apologize for the image. This is in 1968, and they're really hard to reproduce because they're graphite. They're graphite directly onto the wall. But Saul made this at Paula Cooper Gallery in New York in October of 1968. And when he was asked, you know, I was talking about his the influence of Jasper Johns and flatness and this notion of flatness. Well, Saul took flatness one step further by eliminating the object altogether and just drawing directly onto the wall. And here you see him drawing lines in four different directions, and then they're sort of superimposed, and that's why they're darker over here. But he was asked at one point about whether he was the first art. I mean, he's famous for these wall drawings. He created so many in his lifetime, and so he was asked, you know, about inventing the wall drawing, and he made a quip about, I think the cavemen came first. So in some ways, even though he's coming up with this really new way of working, of course it has these, he wasn't the first to do it. It wasn't about being the, you know, grand innovator of this. And it was a basic vocabulary, these lines in different directions. It was a vocabulary he used for throughout the rest of his work. And I wanted to just show you for a second. There are countless images, but this is an acrylic one he did at San Francisco MoMA. If you've ever been to San Francisco and walked into the Botta building, you've seen this in the lobby. This is a work on paper he did, lines in four directions. So again, lines in four directions, the most basic thing, horizontal, vertical, and the two diagonals. And this was from he gave me a book for my birthday, and when I opened it, I noticed he had inscribed it, but I thought it was so interesting that he would have put, it really was his coat of arms, you know, that he would have put the lines in four directions there. But getting back to this wall drawing, you know, the two dimensionality of it, just seemed like, he talked about it as it just made more sense to work directly on the wall rather than create this object to put on the wall. And as he said once, a drawing of a person is not a person, but a drawing of a line is a line. And I look at this work and I think, you know, it seems a line seems so basic and so easy to do. But in fact, having seen these wall drawings done in at the Whitney and watching them get made, I realized that how complicated they are. You know, he said the idea is the machine that makes the work of art, and that the execution is a perfunctory affair. And that's true in spirit, but the reality is not quite that simple. The reality is that it's actually pretty hard. I mean, one of the problems of creating lines in these different directions is first of all, one line might be thicker than another, so then you get this unevenness. Like, and if you have multiple people working on a drawing, everyone's hand is a little bit different. And I had once wrote to him about talking about the skill involved in his work, and this is what he wrote back to me. He said, the first wall drawings relied on clusters of lines derived from the drawing series. This is the work you're seeing here. These clusters were always in four directions, using eventually four colors. At first, I thought that since a line was so basic, it could be drawn by anyone. This is something I still believe, but in doing the clusters of lines, a high degree of skill was needed to focus on not a single line, but the whole end, the end product. And the line was, he talks about, as being just as a vehicle to communicate the idea. The clusters were part of a system, and the system was the subject. The line wasn't the subject, the system was the subject. And what ended up happening, and I'll show you the next wall drawing. This is a little easier one to talk about because it's a better image, but he ended up quickly relegating his wall drawings to trained assistants. And they came up with their own sort of systems and ways of making this. This one is... It may not look like it, but it really is those same lines in four directions again. It's a black wall drawing where, as you can see from the title always includes the instructions, and it says, a 12-inch grid covering a black wall. Within each square, a vertical, horizontal, diagonal right, or diagonal left line bisecting the square. So here you have... Again, those lines in four directions. And what's wonderful about this is here he leaves the direction of each line to be determined by the draftsman. They get to pick which direction goes into each square. And I know that sometimes when people see his work, they are sort of initially maybe troubled by the fact that he isn't always creating his own wall drawings. He isn't actually the person executing them. But if you really think about it, and it's an analogy he often made to that of a composer. I mean, he's really the composer. This art is about ideas. This is not someone trying to copy a Van Gogh, which would be an absurd thing and wouldn't be, you know, would not be the would be a sort of false imitation. But his work was about ideas, and like a composer, he creates the score, and the idea is, you know, and the system is the score, and then others can play it, and every time it'll be played differently, but it's still his idea and it's still his work of art. And in fact, deliberately, every time it will be different. You know, here he's actually set up a system where it will never be the same. It will always be different. And I also think there's something really wonderful about the way he uses or used teams of wall draftsmen, because I think it really allowed him to come up with so many more ideas and create so many more works. I mean, if he had to do all of his wall drawings, you know, he would have done about 100 or something. I mean, I can't imagine he'd have to fly all over the world executing wall drawings. He wouldn't have been able to come up with as many ideas and seen as many of his ideas into reality. I also think that in terms of jobs, it's kind of funny when we're listening to this campaign and all the job promotion. I mean, I think Saul LeWitt single-handedly has created a lot of jobs. I mean, his works are being executed all across the country by teams of people everywhere. So, and he also, in addition to leaving things to the discretion of the draftsman, but it was always spelled out what was, he also worked with the contingencies of architecture and did work with particular spaces. This is one of my favorite wall drawings. It's wall drawing number 51, and it's all architectural points connected by straight lines. And here you see as I understand it, this is in Turin, Italy, or Torino, and the wall that he was given to do a wall drawing was kind of yucky. I mean, it just had an outlet. They couldn't remove the outlet. I mean, you know, it had this odd shape. It's hard to tell, but the ceiling, and there were all these sort of walls coming in. And so what he decided to do was to have that generate an idea. And so he connected all the architectural points with snap lines, with what, you know, that sort of architectural tool that you use. And so you see all the corners are connected to all the other corners. And then, of course, the outlets and the sockets down here. And this was also used, this was installed in the Whitney's retrospective, and we basically, one of our jobs was to go through the fourth floor, and like all of us were looking for the ugliest wall. You know, where's the ugliest wall? We need an ugly wall. We need one with lots of sockets and maybe an exit sign. I mean, the more stuff on it, the better. I wonder if it'll be in Mass MoCA. If so, you can count on it being on the ugliest wall there. Here's another installation of it. You can see they can't remove this outlet here clearly. So they've taped it up and they're working around it. But you can see these holes must be some other points, that some other architectural details that they were able to remove and they'll put back in. But they were able to remove for the purposes of making these lines. So I've showed you guys different wall drawings that and how that coat of arms, those lines in four directions, has been such a fertile system, and he's come up with so many different variations and permutations on that. But in 1970, he started creating works with not straight lines. And you can see here, this is a detail because it doesn't reproduce well. You can see here that it's vertical lines, not straight, not touching, uniformly dispersed with maximum density covering the entire surface of the wall. And this work was done in May of 1970. And I mention that date really precisely because May of 1970 is when his dear friend Eva Hesse passed away. I think she was in her mid-30s. And up until this point, as I said, he'd only been using straight lines, but he decided that it was really an homage to her. He was asked about it afterwards. It was really an homage to her. And because if you look at this work here that I have on view here, Contingent, you can see that her work was incredible. I mean, there were almost no straight lines in Eva Hesse's work. It was always these wonderful organic contours. And the materials she used were things like fiberglass and cotton and different fabrics and much more sort of delicate materials that weren't hard-edged. And he wrote at one point in describing his use of the not straight lines, he said, "I wanted to do something at the time of her death that would be a bond between us and our work. So I took something of hers and mine, and they worked together well, the line being something he worked with and the not straight being hers. You may say it was her influence on me." And you'll see that this not straight line wasn't just a one-time homage, one wall drawing. It actually appears throughout the rest of his work. I mean, this is a, becomes part of his system. And I should mention that I think it's really telling that the Dia Beacon show that he helped, you know, lay out or pick some of the works from, I think it's very telling that the first work in that exhibition is this wall drawing. It was also in the Whitney retrospective. I think it's also always telling when an artist holds on to something in their own collection, and this has been in his collection since he made it in 1970. So I think that's also telling. But you don't here you see again the not straight line in a 1971 work, because this opens up his work in exciting ways. He's able to do all sorts of new things. So this is a work that's in color chart, and I'm just showing a detail because if I showed the whole thing, you'd think I was playing a practical joke on you because it looks like a white wall. You just can't see it in reproduction. So here you see a detail of the grid, and it's a 6-inch grid covering the whole wall. Picture a whole wall filled with squares like this, and as you can see from the directions, it says, within each square, not straight lines from side to side, using red, yellow, and blue pencil. Not straight lines, again, red, yellow, and blue. And isn't it interesting, when he starts using color, he just uses the primary colors, and you could sort of say black or graphite, the regular pencil is you know, the fourth. And lines in four directions, so it kind of is a perfect system. You've got the four colors, essentially, the primary is in the graphite, and lines in four directions. This system, it actually works kind of perfectly. And here, you can barely see the yellow lines, but as you can see, the only restriction he gives to the wall draftsman is that each square has to include at least one line of each color. So the draftsmen can do whatever they want. They can put in three blue lines, they can put in four yellow, as long as it just has one of each. So again, it's never going to be the same twice. And there's a way that his wall drawings, I think, are so kind of wonderfully subversive, in the sense that, first of all, the work very often just by virtue of walls, they're never the same twice. It's not a fixed thing. He also really subverts the system by, if you think of the fact that his wall drawings can be in two places at once. I mean, we had wall drawings at the Whitney, and just if a private collector owned one, we weren't about to tell them they had to paint it out in their house in order for us to display it at the Whitney. So it's in their house and it's at the Whitney at the same time. And how many artworks do you know that the same artwork can be in two places at once? I've always thought that was kind of cool. And then also the insurance values and transportation costs. I mean, we're used to working with the registrar's department to, you know, ship all these works of art to the museum, and they just love the fact that, well, there's nothing to ship, you know? It's like, we just, you know, and the insurance value is usually the cost to replace something, and even though these are irreplaceable, there's, you know, they can be redone. So the insurance value is just the cost of the materials. And he manages to subvert all the systems in this way. And I also wanted to talk a tiny bit about the grid, and because it became just the same way the lines in four directions is something he used throughout his whole career, the grid was also sort of a starting point for so many works. And he talked at one point, he didn't like to speak publicly, he didn't like to lecture, but I found an archival lecture he gave at MoMA in 1978 when MoMA had a big exhibition of his work. And he was asked by someone about Agnes Martin's work. I don't know if you're familiar with her work. It's on view right now on the fourth floor. And she is known for using the grid. And he said, you know, that he had seen her work, and that it was. But at the time that he saw it in the early 60s when he was starting out, he didn't really think of it as an influence. And he says in this lecture, you know, I first saw Martin's work in the early 60s when I was trying to figure out what I was doing. When I started to do three-dimensional grids, I realized that it really came from her thinking. As a matter of fact, the first time I met her, I said, thank you for the grid. I would love to have seen that encounter. Thank you for the grid. And again, you see this way that the grid, in all of its logic and its systematicness, that there's a way in which his systems are so open and his work is so open, and that it can change in so many different times, and that it's also this collaboration with the draftsperson who is given certain parameters to work in and choices that they're able to make. And I also wanted to mention that this work that you see in color chart has, it's related, he would... each idea would lead sometimes to the next, and there are sort of five works that are similar to this one. So one of the related works, and they all have these six-inch grids, and another one is just like this, but it has straight lines in the squares. And then another variation, a different work, is it has straight lines, but the lines don't touch the edges of the square. And then another one has each color assigned a direction. So like red would be, you know, across the middle, or yellow would be a vertical line. So they're each assigned an actual direction. And I love the way his own systems allowed him to be, you know, to come up with new things. And he himself couldn't even always, wasn't always controlling exactly where his work led him. And this is another, a similar work in the sense you can't see its grid, but this is one of the ones at Beacon. But I was mentioning again how he would use the three different colors as lines in different directions. So here he's got blue coming from the corner, red coming from the middle of the wall, and then yellow coming from the center. And the random points of the grid are the part that the draftsman gets to pick. They can pick that, so it'll be different every time. And let me show you the other piece in color chart. And this, I just have to say, was a revelation to me because I had never seen this work. I think it's only been executed besides the original time, maybe one other time. I think Saul first did it in at a pier in Brooklyn, I believe. So it may have been an outdoor work is what it sounds like. But it's a work that he did that the instructions are 12-inch square filled by using all of the Crayola crayons in the pack of 12. So literally what that means is that the draftsman, there were two, would have to use it, you know, a yellow crayon until they, like, it was, there was no more crayon. You know, they had to just like go and cover the square pretty evenly. And this is on a wall. I just have a detail here showing you it close up, but picture it being just this 12-inch square on a wall. Better yet than picture it, just go up into the exhibition after this on the sixth floor and see it for yourself. But you really look at the work and you have no idea that this is, you can't imagine that this is how it's created. You kind of, it has this very unfamiliar look to it, as a critic described as looking like a rhinoceros skin, and it does. It has this amazing texture. But what's great is that I wanted to know is, well, which order of the crayons did they use? You know, because it would look so different each time. And in fact, there is no prescription. I mean, you see the instructions. They got to do whatever they wanted in terms of order. And I have, it ends up in looking very purple and sort of pink. And here is, sorry for the, you know, sort of poor quality images. This is just sort of trying to see it as it's being made. And you can see the first color was green, and then it's black, and then it's orange, brown. I don't have a slide. Sorry for the fifth. I forget what the fifth one was, yellow. And then up until purple. And there's something wonderful about the fact that there are 12 crayons in the pack and 12 and it's a 12-inch square. I mean, he was always doing funny things with numbers there. And as I understand from the curatorial assistant working on the project, that the pack of 12 doesn't exist anymore. Crayola has changed things since then, and it's so they had to kind of take a pack of 24 and then find the original 12, which is kind of a funny thought in and of itself. And this is another color work where I just wanted to show you how he's done wall drawings in so many different kinds of places and taking advantage of again, architecture here. And this is a work he did in Italy on the ceiling where the lines would have been picked by the draftsman in terms of their length. And I wanted to talk about the ink wash wall drawings before I wrap up. And these were... These ink wash drawings, after doing a decade's worth or more of pencil drawings and colored pencil drawings, his art sort of takes this new direction. And it's in the early 1980s, he moves to Italy and lives there for quite a while. And he also gets married. And all of these things, he starts, I think his work really, you can almost sense the sort of influence of frescoes, but it's still on Saul's terms. You know, he still has the same systems in place and drawing directly onto the wall, but he's using these really lovely, like lush jewel-like ink wash colors. And all that you see here, it's all still using that red, yellow, blue. So when you see a purple or you see a certain shade of pink or red, it's because he's layering red, yellow, and blue, to get these colors. So again, he's still using those kind of like primary forms that he started with. But what changes about his work is he moves from lines in four directions to doing that and to squares and cubes to such a range of geometrical shapes, trapezoids and stars and isometric cubes as opposed to just, you know, all the stars and forms derived from a cube. So the shapes just open up enormously. And the color, of course, the palette is opening up too. And you also see him, the systems that he's using. In the past, when you think of a work like incomplete open cubes that I showed you, there are only 122 incomplete open cubes. Like there are no more. Here, he had wall drawings where there were only so many permutations within a system. Here he's working with systems like working with systems that are infinite, potentially infinite, you know, forms derived from a cube. There's not just 122 of those, there's just an infinite number of them, especially if you do them all in different colors and change the color of a look at these. These are all forms derived from a cube, and I know you can't see them well, but it, you know, if you just change even that color, then, I mean, there's an infinite amount of them. His work really, really opens up. And here I just wanted you to see, the process of actually making them and see this. This is one of the wall drawings that was in the Whitney's retrospective. And also the fact that even though he'd already been working with wall drawings that were in rooms, and filling whole rooms, I think really, you know, being steeped in the art of Italy, he was doing more, if you think of the wonderful, like Giotto's Arena Chapel or some of the other fresco cycles that fill a whole space, you start to see a lot of his wall drawings doing the same thing. And this is one of my favorite ink wash wall drawings. It's at the National Gallery, and it will be in the Mass MoCA show, I believe. And it's again, you see the lines in four directions, but just by changing the medium, it becomes, and also by orienting it in a horizontal way here for the horizontal wall of the National Gallery, he's come up with something new. And I wanted to show you the diagram and certificate that accompany it because the diagram actually outlines all the color choices. And, you know, it's hard to even predict what these colors are going to look like just based on his diagrams. And you can see, so this band, which corresponds to the, you know, these bands here, RGB, RBGRG, this is one red, one blue, one gray, one red, one gray. And then it's, you know, RRYR, red, red, yellow, red. I mean, who's to know how these are actually going to end up looking? But this is, and if he had, you'll notice also that there are almost always 3 to 5 letters or colors. And that's because if you keep going and you do more, it just becomes a muddy mess. But here you sort of see how he's giving the specifications to the draftsman. And here is one of the acrylic wall drawings that he did. This is opened the show at the Whitney. It was called Loopy Doopy. And I should say that Saul came, you know, I think when you're working and to create these wall drawings, of course there's a little bit of nervousness on the part of the draftsman to make sure, they want to make sure they're doing it right. And even though the instructions are all there, what if the lines are too dark, or what if the spacing isn't quite right? So, but it's interesting, when Saul came and looked at the show after it was being installed, he really didn't make changes. As long as the instructions are followed out, that, you know, the work of art was correctly done. But the one thing he did, he was very particular to, which I thought was telling, was the colors here. Here with the acrylics that he started using in the 1990s, he really wanted the colors to pop. And I think this is sort of like an Albers-inspired work in some ways because of the way that the colors, that having this purple next to red just changes the way you see the purple and sort of the optical effect of them. And that was the one thing I remember. There were some extensive debates about the color purple and whether it was, you know, whether this popped enough. And you can see that this is one of the structures he did that was also in the exhibition. And I wanted to conclude with this wall drawing. It's wall drawing number 1248. That's about one of the last works he did. It was actually just recently realized after he passed away at Pace. And you can see it's a really go to their website. They actually have like video footage where you can watch it being created. But you can see how he was. You can see how he was working again, still with pencil. So even though I sort of divide it, you know, he was working with pencil and colored pencil initially, and then ink washes, and then acrylic. You know, he was always sort of working on all of these things at the same time. And this work, I feel like I think someone told me, and I thought this was a really good comparison, that it reminded them of Seurat drawings. There's just something incredibly wonderful about the graphite that he used here. And I wanted to conclude with this quote, which is one he made recently: "Every wall is a door." And I just love that quote. I think it's kind of funny, first of all. Every wall is a door. It just sounds like completely, you know, how is every wall a door? Well, of course, every wall is a door for him, because every wall drawing he made opened a door to something else, led somewhere else. Each idea opened up, you know, opened up and was a catalyst for the next. And I also love this idea of every wall being a door too, because we think of paintings and the tradition of painting as being a window onto the world. And instead of a window, he's given us a door. So I think there's something also kind of humorous about it. And I think that even though I hope that from going from the rectangular, open rectangular structure that I showed you in the beginning to up through some of the wall drawings in his career, I hope you see that even though he's working from a system and concepts, that the work is actually so incredibly open and generous and versatile, and there's such variety, such variety to it. And even though I think Saul's work completely moved away from art that's all about someone's inner biography or inner soul. I mean, that was not what he was about. I do think, though, that generosity that you see in his work, that's the one thing that I've always felt was so much connected to who Saul was as a person. And I just, when we worked on the show at the Whitney, I will never forget when he asked me to sit down with him and write down the names of everyone who worked on the exhibition, every intern, everyone. He had made a series of prints for everyone who worked on the show. I have number 13 out of 65. I see it every day when I wake up. I'll never forget that, you know, the day that I spent at the office, instead of answering phone calls, I literally spent a whole day passing out these prints to everyone in the museum as a thank you from him for all their hard work on the show. And I do think that every time I see these wall drawings that I see that generosity in them. So I'm going to conclude there. Thanks so much. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask them at the end.